Empower your leadership journey with the CEO Series. Whether you're at the gym, strolling, or commuting, our impactful dialogues with world-class leaders are just a click away. Immerse yourself in the minds of visionaries shaping today's most influential companies and innovations. It's not just an interview. It's a masterclass in leadership. Don't miss out. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and major streaming platforms.
Good morning, good evening, depending upon what part of the world you're in. If it's Friday, you know it is the CEO Series. We bring together the most inspiring leaders, entrepreneurs, innovators from across the globe to share their insight. Today, we have as our guest, Carol Heimowitz, an award-winning journalist with a remarkable career. She's a regular contributor to the Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg Businessweek, and other publications, and she's an adjunct professor at NYU's University Arthur J. Carter Institute of Journalism. Her impactful reporting has covered topics like leadership, the glass ceiling, gender-related issues, etc. Let's dive into this incredible journey in journalism. Carol, how are you?
Very good. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. To let the audience know, Carol was with the Wall Street Journal, and she featured me in an article that she wrote, and you could not I could not tell you what that meant to me to be in the Wall Street Journal as opposed to working from here to here, and you go right to the top. So thank you for being here. So talk us through your career. How did you go from journalism school to the top of the pyramid, as I call it?
Well, I was quite lucky to, after journalism school, to get a job at the Wall Street Journal. But what made that possible, I think, I came from New York, had returned there after college and went to journalism school in New York at Columbia. But when I started looking around in New York for jobs, it was tough. People didn't want to hire new reporters in the heart of media land.
Right.
So when I reached out to the Journal, they were willing to talk to me and liked the writing I showed them, but they said, are you willing to leave New York? And don't tell us yes, if you really mean no. And I said, yes, I'm willing to leave. And that's when I got an offer, an interview, and ultimately an offer at the Pittsburgh Bureau of the Wall Street Journal, which people thought Pittsburgh, no one wants to go to Pittsburgh. It turned out to be a great launching pad for me in many, many ways. Mm-hmm. And I realized that wherever you are, there are amazing stories and amazing things happening. Mm. So that's the start of my career.
Wow. Pittsburgh to New York. Because as you were telling that story, I'm thinking Wall Street Journal, Wall Street, and then Pittsburgh.
Well, the Journal at that point had, and they still do, bureaus. They were based on a bureau system, and they had bureaus throughout the United States, where primarily in cities with a lot of corporate headquarters and around the world. Okay. So they put the newer reporters out in the bureaus.
Okay, to get some seasoning and
whatnot. Right.
Yeah, yeah. So what did you take away from that first stop in Pittsburgh? Because you would probably not think of Wall Street Journal Pittsburgh. So starting as a cub reporter, which was the term back then.
Yeah. I'll tell you a story of one of my first stories in Pittsburgh. I was sent to a small town north of Pittsburgh called Meadville. Nobody's heard of it. There are a lot of dairy farms around there. It was the 1980s, very high interest rates, huge inflation. I was supposed to write about farmers, but what I discovered there, I talked to local bankers, and they suddenly told me that they were being crushed because they had given out fixed loans to all the local business people and the farmers, and suddenly interest rates were up at 17%, much worse than today.
Wow.
They didn't know what to do. And I wrote that story. It became a national story.
Really?
Because it was happening throughout rural America and nobody had written about it. Mm-hmm. And I learned an important lesson there. You never know what you're going to find anywhere. And you might think you're in a backwater, but not necessarily. And I found a lot of stories in Pittsburgh that resonated with people all over the country.
Was that a hard sell going back to the big house and saying, I have this angle, I want to expound on it?
And that was what was great about the Journal. It was a bottom-up organization at that point. They really listened to reporters on the ground, and they wanted to hear from, they wanted to be a national paper. This was the only paper at that point that in the U.S. that you could find on any doorstep throughout the U.S. You know, didn't want to be a New York, Washington paper. They wanted to be a national paper. So they listened to the reporters on the ground.
You
were right.
I'm laughing because of the fact I remember getting my first Wall Street Journal subscription and to pick up that paper on my way to the car to commute into New York, you would have thought I had received an Oscar. Because that was the first time I had always admired the paper, and to have my own subscription with my name on the label was one of those moments for me. So you said you wrote that article, and all of a sudden everything kind of blew up as a result of that. Were you prepared for that moment?
Not really. I was surprised that the story had such impact in many places. I hadn't really thought beyond my little pod, and that taught me a lot. Mostly what it taught me was whenever you are, listen to what's going on around you, because you don't know what you're going to hear. I walked into that bank, the first bank that told me about this.
Yeah.
I was not ready to hear this, but I was listening.
Okay. That's so cool that you were able to do that. So is that one of the things you teach your journalism students, that you never know where it can come from?
Absolutely. You never know. And I think that's true in business. Yeah. You don't have to be a journalist. You can be a manager in business. You never know what the important things are coming around that you need to be aware of. And a lot of it comes from listening, not speaking necessarily.
Yeah. So what were some of the results from that? So all of a sudden you got national attention, all of this stuff is coming into you. What do I do now?
I better keep coming up with good ideas. That's what it meant. It wasn't that I had sudden stardom. That was what was expected of you. And I think that was the kind of place it was, wherever you were. If you were in Pittsburgh, you were in Chicago, you were in LA, Africa, you were supposed to come up with ideas that people cared about, that had legs to them.
Okay. So what was next after Pittsburgh?
Well, I actually was in Pittsburgh for quite a while, Ron. I became a manager there, a bureau chief.
Okay.
Ran that bureau. The bureau expanded. It became a regional bureau. It was covering a lot of the Midwest. We covered 450 companies there. Kodak, Federated Department Stores, a ton of companies, not just steel and the industry. So I stayed there. I really became known for grooming younger reporters, bringing them in, hiring good talent, and getting them on their road, and a lot of those people rose very high in journalism, and I was very proud of that. I mean, one of the people I hired ultimately became the managing editor of the Wall Street Journal.
Whoa.
So,
yeah.
But I did eventually transfer to New York. At that point, I was running a group that covered management and leadership issues, and I was writing a leadership column.
Was that where the glass ceiling came about?
The glass ceiling actually happened in Pittsburgh, but... Okay. And I can tell you about that. I mean, it came about because I was always reading annual reports. At that point, everything was paper and we got a ton of annual reports in, and you looked inside and all the pictures of the corporate officers and the boards, no women, no people of color, all white men.
Yeah.
And we started thinking about that. I started talking to women. This was a point that women were starting to move into business ranks, but hadn't been able to move up very far. And at the beginning, I think women, myself included, we felt just so thankful that we were hired. Thank you for hiring us.
Yeah.
For anything.
I'm not going to ruffle anything. Just let
me. Thank you. But after putting in 5-10 years of hard work and you don't rise, you start to feel frustrated.
Yeah.
So that was writing the article, was hearing that over and over and over again from women who had gotten up a little bit. Mm-hmm. Talked to one woman who was a treasurer at a Fortune 500 company, but felt very stuck there.
Yeah.
And somewhere along the line, people we were interviewing used the phrase "the glass ceiling." It was a very catchy phrase.
Branding.
We used it. We had a fabulous picture with
the
journal is such a print
paper,
but they finally did a great illustration of a woman with her hands up against the ceiling, looking up.
Yeah.
And that, I think it's almost a picture
created
the catch to it all.
Oh, wow. So you talk about grooming. Where did that come from? Was that because of what you possibly have struggled with to get to the so-called glass ceiling? When did the grooming piece come in and say, I want to develop the next level of?
Mm-hmm. I think it's part of my nature. I have a more of a tendency to manage down than up, which can be a problem for me. Okay. I think you need a balance of managing up and down. But I also knew that my success rested on, I was in a place where the people I was going to hire for the most part were beginners.
Okay.
That was what Pittsburgh was known for, a beginner place. So I was getting in new talent and I was going to be judged on who I got.
Okay.
They made that clear. So, and I realized I liked it a lot. I learned so much from my young reporters. Mm-hmm. They told me so many things and got so many great stories on page one.
But do you think that's because of your nature? Because in a lot of cases, you know, you look at younger people coming in and they have brilliant ideas.
Mm-hmm.
But the next level will say, no, we're going to hold off on that. And I remember reading an article a few weeks back about the Barbie movie. And they were talking about how the marketing was top shelf, mm-hmm. broke the ceilings and all of that. But someone, a friend of mine, wrote an article about that. And he said, you know what, you have to think, while we can applaud them, we should also applaud the person who gave them the seal of approval or the budget to move forward with that. Because in a lot of cases, he said, this happens every day. People come up with unique ideas.
I totally agree with you. I think that's one of the keys to being a good manager, giving credit where it's due and really supporting the people you're working with, whether it's below you or above you, but certainly below you, not taking all the credit.
Okay. Okay. So in that role as kind of a coach, mentor, and mm-hmm. guidance to people, and all of that was kind of just, I just want to get closer to people, or, you know, so today they'll say, well, did you take a course in coaching or whatever it is?
I didn't take a course in coaching. I think that is part of my nature. I just enjoy getting to know people. I did know it was part of my job to make sure these people succeeded. I was going to be judged on that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I also enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And I spent a lot of time getting to know them and figuring out each person. And I believe this in business, everybody has different talents. Some of my reporters were unbelievable breaking news stars. They loved news. They wanted to break news. Other people were more writers, and you had to play to their strengths.
Wow.
Not try to make everybody the same.
So I'm going to give you some insight. We have a program that we run called Symphonic C-Suite, and it's based on that same principle that every person that reports to you is a different instrument.
Right.
And you have to learn what that instrument produces, and you have to coach them to become a better trombone player, drum.
I totally agree.
Oh, wow.
Rather than putting everyone in one lane and saying, you've got to be only this. Mm-hmm. You're not going to get a good organization that way.
Yeah, yeah. So you were able to so-called create that orchestra, and you kept replicating that, because the time that you were there, a lot of those people were leaving and going on to other things.
They were. Yeah. I had what's called a revolving bureau. I put through at least 5 teams there.
Really?
And they went on to great work overseas, Some of them went to London, Washington, New York, where they rose. They all did very well.
You know,
one of my hires is now running all of the publications at McKinsey.
I know that's got to be a good feeling. You know,
it's a great feeling.
Yeah. I look at people that work for me, and now they are head of HRs and all over the globe, and I'm like, yes.
That's good. It's a wonderful feeling.
It's a wonderful feeling to see young people coming in because, you know, one of the other things I want to talk about for a minute, because of your background and what you built as being a coach and just growing people, if you had to advise a CEO conference and you were a keynote, what are some key lessons that you would tell them about maybe how you sink in what you've gone through to where you are today, and what should they be cognizant of?
Okay, two things. Motivate, don't berate. Really, motivate, don't berate. It's so important. I've seen too many CEOs barking orders and not really listening to the people under them. Mm-hmm. You've got to create, as a CEO, it is so hard to find out what's going on.
Yeah.
You're so isolated, really.
Yeah.
People are afraid to talk to you. Mm-hmm. So it's the very rare CEO who creates some sort of mechanism, some sort of avenue to find out from people in the ranks what's happening. And a few of them do it. I've only met a few where they have a lunch and they really tell people, this is completely between us. It's off the record. I'm not talking to your boss. Just tell me your concerns. Tell me your thoughts. They do that. Or you've heard the term walking around. I don't know how much you get about walking around, but.
Well, you know what? I call that a pre-COVID term because nobody walks around.
Now we're walking around now, right. Everybody's on lawn.
Yeah. Go ahead. No, the walking around piece, I use that metaphor when I was at Martha Stewart. Every morning and every afternoon, I would just walk. And we went Starrett Building, which is over by the water, which was a big block. So I just walk around and not see meetings. I just go sit in meetings. And when you would do those kinds of things, you got closer to people, to the actual business, and not the HR stuff.
Right.
So talk to me how that came about, understanding that so-called walk around.
Well, I think there was a recognition at a certain point, especially as companies got larger and larger, that the top ranks were more and more isolated. And I've certainly met many CEOs who the only people they talk to really is the senior team and their board. Mm-hmm. They've lost complete touch with everybody else.
Yeah.
And you're not going to get a lot of great ideas that way. Mm-hmm. You're not going to find out the mood of your company.
Okay.
And this is especially important now at a time of high turnover when there isn't any loyalty anymore.
Yeah.
People are moving in and out, in and out. They kind of stay during hard times. The minute times get better, they're looking for the next opportunity.
Yeah.
You want to keep your best people. You've got to get to know them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think walking around came out of that recognition. If you don't start talking to the people in your ranks, you're going to lose out.
Yeah. A friend of mine posted this morning because she had been at this company for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
She was a senior executive. And I sent her a note. I said, I have never heard of a person that's been there with that amount of tenure, ever. And I'm in human resources. So but I flipped that to say, I appreciate a company that can create a culture that would make people want to stay
for
30 years. The other side of that.
Right. And maybe you'll only get 10 years for the most part now, but 10 years is a lot.
Yes.
I think the average stay is 5 now.
Okay. So what advice would you, let's flip that situation to CEOs, and you're talking to young journalists who were excited about getting in. It could be writing. It could be about breaking stories or whatever it is. What is some key advice that you would give just starting my career?
I'd give them two pieces of advice. One is, at this point, you're your own career manager. The day is when it's up to you to figure out what you love, what you need to advance, who you need to get to know, build your network. It's not going to come from somebody else helping you, because a lot of companies there is less time for that. And they've abandoned a lot of that career grooming, and they're not grooming people for lifetime jobs. So it's up to you. The second thing I tell young people is plan for a very long career. You're going to live long.
Yeah.
You're going to work longer maybe than your parents did. You're not going to retire at 55. You're not necessarily going to retire at 65. You're going to have a very long career. That means very different planning. You've got to keep learning. You've got to take breaks to get new knowledge. You've got to realize you're going to have two or three or four careers.
Mm-hmm.
This is totally different than your grandparents and your parents.
So that takes us to what you've been working on, the aging aspects of the workforce. Can you kind of give us some highlights on that research you've done and some of the key things you're writing about?
A gradual escalation in the number percentage of people who are wanting to work longer. It's primarily in white collar ranks. If you have a blue collar job, you tend to be more worn out by the time you hit 60, 65. And some of those people have still managed to have pensions. But if you're white collar, you're vibrant, you're healthy, you don't want to give it up. One of my journalism students is writing about a story about how pilots are now fighting the retirement age of 65. They don't want to get out. They want to keep going. They feel healthy. So this is a change for companies. They have to suddenly deal with how do we keep people on because we might need their talents, but keep moving up the young ones. And they've got to try to balance it and talk to people of all generations and say, we need you all. And the older people have to realize they're not necessarily always going to be the bosses. They want to stay on. They might take a consulting role. They might might report to somebody 20, 25 years younger. If you can't accept that, you're not going to fit in anymore. Because it's not about age anymore. It's about skills. It's about talent. It's not your age that gives you tenure.
I think a lot of leaders are going to have to learn that.
Yes.
Yeah, they're going to have to learn that. I know so many, a buddy of mine who was saying he could not wait till the day that he retired, and he did that. He was a doctor, and he went out, and he said he's going to play golf. I talked to him 6 months later. He said, that's over with. He said, that little dream I had, he said, had no relevance because you get bored. I'm still active and I want to go back. And he went back as the medical director, not really into the day-to-day, but more of a guidance leadership role.
Right. And a lot of people who want to work longer, this is a new path. And you hear it in a lot of journalism stories, next chapter. That's a phrase, my next chapter. They're leaving a main company they've worked at or a main profession, and they're starting something different. They're using what they know and generally and starting something different, like your friend.
Yeah. So I always tease my lawyer friends. I said, I think I know more lawyers that are not lawyering anymore.
Right. Right. Exactly. But they're probably doing something they enjoy.
Because
usually when you're working, not always, there's a whole group of people who never had a chance to save for retirement. They are working for money. That's at a lower level. But at the skilled professional level, people are working because they like work. They feel fulfilled.
You know what? I always use the metaphor whenever I'm doing a session. You know, everybody knows what TGIF is. And everybody says, yay. I said, what about TGIM?
Right. I love that.
Yeah. So there's always a pause. I said, I'm a TGIM. I can't wait. I can't wait until, if I'm in the Middle East, I can't wait for Sunday. If I'm in the U.S., I can't wait for Monday because I love what I do. But it took a while to get to that point.
That's right. And that's part of also why people want to work longer, because it took a while to really find out what they love and what they're particularly good at and what most fulfills them. And that might not happen until they're 60. They want to keep going with it.
Yeah. I call it
life is long, hopefully, and healthy.
I call it finding you.
Yes.
We got to find you.
And that takes a lifetime.
It takes a lifetime. So I want to kind of do a little shout out for some of our frequent listeners. Joe Levy, who I worked with at IBM years ago, he says, motivate, but don't berate. Karen Hilton is a very dear friend of mine who was also a guest on the show. Says, Godfather retired from pharma. He couldn't sit still. He's busier than ever and is using his professional skills to consult. So again, talking through that. And then my dear friend, John Self, who started as a newspaper reporter, and now he's an executive coach in transition. I mean, it just goes on and on.
Right.
Of people making that switch. So what advice would you give someone who's close to, they see the window? I was talking to someone the other day. My neighbor was putting up lights for Thanksgiving, and he and I was talking. He said, yeah, Ron, he said, I got 3 more years ago. I said, 3 more years ago, what? He said, before I retire. I said, then what? He said, retire. I said, no, then what? He said, I retire. I said, then what?
Then what?
You need to think of that.
You really do. The advice is to, first of all, try to spend some time really self-reflecting yourself on, make a list, something, listen to some music and make a quick list of all the things you've done during your working life that's extended over many years at this point. Yeah. What have you most loved? Just not the job, but the function within that you most loved, that gave you the most pleasure. And then talk to people. I think it's very important to talk to people who did retire and just play golf.
Yeah. Yeah.
Versus people who are doing something different.
Yeah.
And get a feel for how they're each doing and form. Sometimes it helps to form a little group of people who are going through this.
Yeah. Yeah. I call it my board.
Yes.
I don't want to sound too pompous, but I have a board of directors for me. People, I just call them and say, this is what I'm thinking. What do you think? They said, that's the dumbest idea ever. I just said, that's pretty cool. See what you talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
Bouncing it off reflection.
Right. There's a really good new book out on this, written by a former friend of mine from the Wall Street Journal, Joanne Lippman. It's called Next. Very good book on what to think about, what people go through in transitions.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the reflection piece that you mentioned is important because I think from me talking to people from my side is people don't do that enough. They're on a path and they're trying to gauge it because someone else did that, but they don't come back in.
Right.
You know, and to the Ron Thomas concept of finding me, who I am.
And I think you need a special time of the day where that you can do that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. For some people, it's very early in the morning. Other people, it's driving in their car.
Yeah.
Other people in the evening, and figure out what time that is and really devote.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need hours. Spend 15 minutes doing it a couple of times a week.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's get back to starting in Pittsburgh. Now, you've edited stories for the Pulitzer Prize. You've received all these awards. What was key to that? I told you, to give you a little background again, when you did the article on me in the Wall Street Journal, that was like I had reached nirvana. I mean, that was it. Could never go any higher than that. So what was your moment?
Well, I will tell you about somebody I worked with who won a Pulitzer because it meant a lot to me. I could tell you about a story I did, but let me tell you about Tony Horowitz's story. He won a Pulitzer for national coverage. And it tells you the process of how things worked at the Journal.
Mm-hmm.
Tony was somebody who he didn't want to write about executives. He wanted to write about workers. He's an incredible writer. Died fairly young, unfortunately, but of a heart attack. But he wrote a lot about workers. And he was very interested in what were the new hard jobs, the jobs that had occurred because of technology that were new or changes in lifestyle, mm-hmm. rather than the coal mining of the old era, what's going on now? And he came up with a list. And one of them was poultry plants, because people were eating less meat and more chicken. He also came up with data and other things, but he decided he wanted to write about this. To go through the process, I trusted his thinking, but we had to go to New York, all of us, get around a table with top editors and hash out the idea a little bit and think about. And we kind of sold the managing editor on the idea. And Tony not only wanted to write about it, he wanted to actually go into the factory and be a worker.
Wow.
That was very tricky because you can't lie to get in. You can't pretend you're... So the managing editor agreed. He said, all right, you can do it. It's not done any now. It's impossible to do this. But he did. He said he figured out a way to do it. He showed up at a poultry plant in the deep south. And when they asked him where he worked, he said he worked at Dow Jones. They didn't know what that was. So okay. They hired him. He wrote this amazing story about mm-hmm. what it was like to be on a line, a processing plant line. And
wow.
And he wrote about other jobs as well and won the Pulitzer. I'm bringing this up to show it took his spotting what the story was, doing a lot of research, but yeah. then selling it to everyone and getting all our buy-in and our ideas. Tony would call me after his shift and talk to me about it was late at night, what was going on, how exhausted he was, how he was managing to take notes in the bathroom during breaks.
Wow. Okay.
And we talked it through. And so,
you know, you mentioned being a worker. There was an article in Dubai the other week of Lufthansa CEO.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of times a year, he will work economy and he'll work business class.
You see,
just to get a sense. So that could be the new walk.
That's the new walk around.
I mean, in doing that, because you understand that. And I go back to my time at Martha Stewart when I left IBM, which was technically a company, training company, but it was a business. And then when I was sitting in a creative meeting and looking at the way they choose colors and all those things, it was a total learning atmosphere for me.
Absolutely. That is the really talented walk around.
Yeah.
To doing, very few people do that. Good for him.
So when you were talking before about the CEO board, my level, and what they were saying was to come down and do that. The gentleman who's the CHRO for UPS a couple of times mm-hmm. a year, he flies to a city, puts on the brown uniform, and he rides the truck.
Which is great. That's what you need to do.
Yeah. I love that. So talking about essential influences in your life, can mm-hmm. you spotlight some of those people who were kind of a guiding influence and kind of built Carol into the Carol today?
I worked for some amazing and with some amazing editors who were leaders in the company at the Wall Street Journal. Somebody named Norm Perlstein was managing editor for quite a while. He went on to run a lot at Time Inc. and then he ran the LA Times. He's done an enormous amount. He just encouraged me and other people to take risks.
Yeah.
Go out there, take risks, find what you feel passionate about and what keeps you up at night thinking and mm-hmm. go for it mm-hmm. and don't be afraid. Mm-hmm. And, he kind of would throw ideas up in the air and say, just find your own ideas, but you can grab one of mine too. And yeah. wow. that was great.
Yeah.
My mom was also a big influence on me. My mom was a school teacher.
Yeah.
She didn't have a career when I was first born, but she ultimately became a school teacher and she really loved it. And she ultimately became an assistant principal in a public school. And I think she had the view, I have two sisters, no brothers. She wanted us to find things we loved and to say we could have yeah. a great work life.
Yeah, yeah. My father was a taxi driver. He owned a taxi company in a little town in South Carolina. And mm-hmm. I learned more from him about business than any of the other stuff that I've gone through, you know, with degrees and certifications.
Right.
Yeah, it was just when he would come in at night, just sitting next to him and him talking about the challenges of the day or whatever it is. And not that he did very well this week. This week was a lesson in business. So by the time I got out of high school, I had an MBA.
It's great. It's
yeah. Wonderful. Yeah. In doing that. So when you talk about leaders and the importance that leaders make in people's lives, specifically younger people coming in, I think that there has to be a different role and they need to understand the impact they're having on the next generation of people that's coming up.
absolutely. I mean, I see the difference between positive and negative leadership. I mean, positive leadership is inspirational. It provides an example, but it's not so me oriented, me, 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 I'm the king, it's only me, that it doesn't give the other person a chance to find themselves. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting balance. One CEO I wrote about who had an ability to do a lot of that was Daniel Vasella, who ran Novartis quite a while ago. And he turns out, I found out he had, before he became a CEO and a man, he'd been a psychoanalyst.
Really?
He didn't tell people that, but he had a great ability to understand people and who they were. And he really used that in his, I think a lot of leaders don't realize that they're being constantly watched.
Yeah.
If they look depressed or angry, that's going to have an effect on their staff. Yeah. If they do all sorts of things that can have an effect on their staff. Mm-hmm. So you have to be aware of that. I learned that early as a manager.
Yeah.
I'm very self-critical. So I remember a young reporter giving me a story she'd just written, and I started to figure out what was wrong with it. And I looked up and I saw her whole face had dropped.
Yeah.
And I realized I can't do to my reporters what I do to myself.
Exactly.
More positive.
Yeah. Yeah. So I see John Self talked about Herb Keller. He worked at the ramp loading bags for the holidays. Mm-hmm. He was the founder of Southwest Airlines. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But again, it's getting connected to workers. I had a CEO years ago in Dubai, and he's telling me what a great leader he is, and he's just going through all these accolades. But I noticed that the HR person would not even make eye contact. And what I found after that, she said that in his head he is, but he comes in every day. He doesn't live that. He comes in every day and doesn't even say something as simple as good morning to people.
And that has a huge impact on his staff. Mm-hmm. They're thinking he doesn't care about us.
Yeah.
He's just caught up in himself. They feel neglected.
So as you talk about the aging in a workforce, mm-hmm. we talked about that angle. What are your thoughts on the so-called four-day work week? Because that's kind of going back and forth. It's kind of like the badminton. It's just keeps going back and forth. It's been saying one thing, you know, what's his name? JP Morgan Chase, the guy from there. He says everybody needs to be back. Jamie Dimon. He says everybody needs to be back 3 days a week, 4 days a week, whatever it is. What are your thoughts on this new concept of work?
Well, I do think it's complicated. I think there's something invaluable about all being in the same place and having contact around a table rather than on a screen.
Yeah.
But I also really believe, especially in the digital age when we're always online, even, you know, if you're coming into an office, you're still online at night, that having a 4-day week or even a 3-day week, depends on the industry, it can really benefit your staff. Mm-hmm. A lot for 4 days, you could get a lot done. Mm-hmm. And you're still going to answer your email and your text in an emergency or come to an emergency meeting. Yeah. But a lot of to get that work-life balance, it's really important. And the reason COVID turned into a mixed blessing, people hated being confined, but they loved not having the commute.
Exactly.
It's not being in the office. It's the long commute.
Yeah.
It lengthens your day.
Yeah. There was a client that I worked with. I was in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, maybe 3-4 weeks ago. And one of the clients was a bank. And what he told me was that the mortgage processing unit, when they went into COVID, all of a sudden their productivity increased. It increased almost 80%.
Exactly.
And when he got everybody on a call trying to figure out why these numbers were increasing, and this basically said, you know what? I don't have to commute. I can work until X amount of time when my husband comes in from his job. He can take over the kids. I can work to 10, 11 o'clock at night.
Exactly.
And when it came time for them to readjust post-COVID, he told us, the CEO says, my department will consistently work from home. And then he gave the business case as to why. And I said, fine.
Right. I agree with that. I mean, I think a hybrid is the best solution. Yeah. Yeah. 3 days in, 2 days out.
Yeah.
But I've heard from a lot of millennials who say they get more work done at home.
They work good. Yeah.
Because they can focus in. They're not, most people don't have a private office anymore. They're sitting on a long table and there's a lot of distractions. So
yes. So in the article, Josh Burson wrote an article who's well noted in this field, and he says the 2019 era and before, that's over. Forget about it. You can't recreate it. You got to figure out a way to make it happen going forward.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's interesting to me why some people, I can see certain jobs, probably if you're an investment banker, that's more of a job where you have to be in more.
Yeah.
In terms of the meetings and the teamwork and whatever, even that though, but a lot of jobs work very well online.
Yeah. So I'm reading the book now from Gallup. Jim Harter just wrote a book. I forget the name of it now. And he's talking through the stats because Gallup is always based on evidence. And they were talking through this new change of the work model and all these things, are moving into place. And as I was listening to that the other day, I said, I'm going to send this to every CEO friend of mine because you're still holding on to the way that you grew up in a business.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's different.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's true. Where were you during COVID, Ron?
I was in Dubai, locked down for 2 weeks. And this is how this show started. We were trying to figure out something to do. And we said, let's just do an interview show. We started writing, send you the questions, and we put us on the website that wasn't getting it. So let's just try something new. And we came up with this series. And all of my staff, who were absolutely awesome, put it all together. And I just log on and talk.
It's great. Yeah, now you know a lot too.
Yeah, so that's how all
you
that
know came. A lot about leadership.
And yeah, so that's how all that came about. So what are some key things you're working on now that you're very excited about?
Mm-hmm. I'm still working on the aging, and I'm working on what enables some people to keep going and to keep changing.
Yeah,
because I think that's one of the most important aspects of having a successful career, that you have to be very adaptable.
Yeah.
And some people do that better than others.
Yeah.
I think it's because they allow themselves to be beginners over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Oh, beginners. So, I like that.
Okay. Allow themselves to be beginners and start and not be perfect at it, even if they have a ton of experience in something else, but they try something else.
Yeah.
So that's one thing I'm working on.
Go ahead.
And I've been actually writing a lot about late love.
Oh.
Wrote a piece for the Wall Street Journal on that. Huge number of people who are older, they've either been widowed or divorced or.
Okay.
And who are finding one another.
Yeah.
And I know everybody's watching The Golden Bachelor, but it's not like The Golden Bachelor. There's a lot of different issues for
me. Yeah, that's a TV show. That's a whole lot of other.
Right.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of underpinnings on that. So, go ahead.
I'm not just writing about business anymore, although I do. I do write for Bloomberg. Okay. And,
yeah. Well, I think you've made your stamp in the so-called Journalism Hall of Fame. for the amount of work that you've been doing over the years. Before we close, I just see a note here. I see a note here from Karen Hilton, a very good friend of mine. She said, yes, Carol, I shared this with a client. She couldn't understand why her accomplishments and hard work weren't enough to inspire her team. But once she got a chance to reflect and knowing her blind spots, it was a game changer.
It's great.
Mm. Blind spots. How do we
find them?
Yeah.
That's a great question. Woo.
Any thoughts on that one?
You've got to have your club. You know, you talked about your board around, your self-appointed board around you.
Yeah.
Who are willing to be frank.
Yeah.
And say, do you know you do this? I was actually helped by a few people who worked for me who would tell me when you do X, it really drives us, you know, you take too long to respond about this. Or few people did that. What startles me is the number of bosses out there who do performance reviews who aren't frank with people. Or they don't even know them enough to do a performance review that's valuable.
Yeah.
So again, you're often left on your own. Mm-hmm. I think you have to, again, spend time reflecting and see what areas have you not done as well as you would like.
Mm-hmm.
And then think about it quietly. And then maybe talk to people who know you.
Yeah. Speaking of late love, Cameron she said, her father got remarried at 81.
That's
great. And a new car, and now he's writing his first book at 84.
Wow, that's great. That's great.
You need to talk to him, right?
Yeah, right. Definitely.
Yeah. So, one of our goals on the show, as we begin to close out, is to create a platform for leaders like yourself. This is share the stories, and I got to say, you brought the masterclass to us today, and we enjoyed having you as a guest on the series. Any last minute thoughts you'd like to share with the audience for being a guest on the show?
Mm-hmm. I've so enjoyed this conversation. It's open, it's frank, and collegial, and that's great. And thank you, Ron. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. And thank you again for my first little 15 little, minutes of fame.
You're big.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Stay on, and I'll come back as we close out.
Thank you.
Take the CEO series with you anywhere, anytime. All episodes are now available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and major streaming platforms. It's not just an interview. It's a masterclass in leadership.